Here. I'm going to read the verse, so please make kasha. May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and walk with unfaltering step this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha,
all right, so third class of the precepts. We've been kind of working our way through the Kyoji Kaiman document that we read at the beginning of meditation. And tonight we're getting into the first three of the grave precepts. Do not kill, do not steal, do not impose sexuality. And then don't misuse sexuality. And then what I want to start with is, how is the recollection practice going? So that was kind of the homework assignment for this last week. For people who weren't here last week, it was taking a moment at the end of each day or sometime near the end of each day and remembering how the day went, noticing, just kind of pulling it through the mind and noticing how you respond in that moment to what happened during the day, with the idea that over time there will be some kind of patterns that emerge. So how has that gone for you this week?
I'm kind of concerned. I'm working with judgments right now, so I'm trying to notice judgment, either critical or any judgment, you know, especially if it sends me down a path of some kind. And so what I've been doing, what's been working for me is, through the day I'm counting when I notice. So I notice preference, but then if it becomes a judgment, and then I count it. And that actually, so it's not so much at night I'm doing it. I am thinking about it at night too. But it's like real world kind of like, I'm amazed how, now, I'd like to tell you it's less and less. I think it is, honestly. It is, honestly, I think it is. Although I still am in the same kind of numbers area, it's been really useful this week. I'm just noticing it sooner instead of going down, you know. It feels good.
So are you like double digit or triple digit? Per day.
Depending on the day.
So doing the recollection at the end of the night, I think it helps me throughout the day also, because it makes me more aware. It's supposed at the end of the night, and so, I wasted this much time or whatever.
Right.
So it helps me kind of in real time, knowing that I'm going to be doing it.
Someone's
going
to be watching. Oh,
someone's
me.
Watching.
Kind of self-accountability,
I had an interesting experience with that, where my partner, my boyfriend and I, we parted ways early last week. Mm-hmm. And so afterwards I sat down with the precepts and reviewed, like, how did our conversation go? How has all of that been? And something interesting happened where I feel like a lot of them, I was aware of when I was approaching stepping away from the precepts, and I felt the energy come up, and I didn't take the bait. And the interesting that happened is that the relationship needed some sort of, like, actual pitch and, like, fighting to a degree, like just a blip of energy, so that it could have a sense of finality. And adhering to the precepts too much, it was just too gentle. It didn't have the completion. And so I sat with that for a while and was like, okay, know, could I help things any better? And it was very, very
interesting. Yeah, it's one of the things that's really useful about the recollection practice is, you know, recognizing that like kind of like momentariness of like, oh, like there's the actual option of, you know, departure from the precept, you know, and of course like there's a constancy to that, you know, there's layers and layers and layers, but like when we notice it, when it's really in full view that we have that possibility, you know, just making that more accessible, that we can find a way to that when we want to. Yeah.
I was kind of along the lines of what you were saying. You know, I kind of count it up, but I can be really hard on myself. And I always think after meditation, oh, I should be easier on myself. Yeah, I'm so rough. This is not fun. But kind of the sustained effort over the week and thinking about last week with the kind of the beginningless greed, the beginningless karma, and seeing it in my workplace as kind of like, we're all here to do a good job. How can we work together? And how can, when bad things happen, rather than fault finding, mm-hmm. how can I forgive myself? It's easier for me to forgive other people. Then I see, oh, well, then that kind of the unity of forgiving myself is forgiving everyone, and everyone can do a better job. Mm-hmm. So the sustained effort over the week seemed like easier for me to realize what actually is productive.
Nice. Yeah, you know, just that regularity of remembering, oh yeah, I do care about these. You know, that's more frequent throughout the day. It keeps us like that. The leash that we kind of move out on is shorter. Great. Yeah. Okay.
I've been working with, for some time now, some habitual patterns with my partner. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting bringing them into the context of the precepts, the contrition piece, and the taking selfless action. I just really found myself tuning into what that meant and just, you know, letting go of any kind of defending myself and opening myself to the situation. Mm-hmm. I think doing it within the context of the precepts really opened that piece up for me.
And so what was it that was different? Can you zoom in on that at all?
I think it was the focus on the selfless piece and the contrition piece. It was having that language in my head in that context to really, really move that direction more, more consciously.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And was that something that you could talk about with it?
We did. That was another thing I kind of learned was that I think it's important to use a language with the other person. My partner isn't Buddhist, so I wasn't using this language and talking with her. We were creating our own language, and my becoming more open to that allowed that to happen in a way that it hadn't in the past.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So keep on track, you know, when you see it.
And right.
You know, you're okay, I
just
see it,
in that direction.
Right there, and you're holding it, and you're not taking the bait. But then you realize you are taking the bait.
Right.
How do you get yourself out of that? Is it a good thing to just start, like, focusing on your breath at the time, maybe?
Without
beating yourself up.
It might be. I don't think that there's a. You know, I find for myself that there's a lot of different versions of how that might roll out. It's, you know, the like an extra breath never hurt really. I just feel like that little bit of pause to like turn the focus within and kind of see like, okay, well, what's happening right now. And how am I feeling like I don't have an option? And is that really true? And often there's that sense of like there's pressure or there's urgency or like you know, like there's a sense of constraint and tightness. And so if you can just kind of like acknowledge that, oh, right, I'm not feeling free right now. I'm not feeling at ease right now. I'm probably not at my best decision-making capacity. Some of that is extra. Some of that is just kind of misperceiving the situation. But we can't really, like, it's hard to talk yourself into that when you're in that state. And so that's the beauty of being able to just kind of notice, okay, well, right, I'm really agitated right now. That's already changing the situation, just being able to admit that and kind of soften into, well, what's this particular agitation like?
I also find that sometimes it's really helpful to completely sit very still, if that's possible. Sometimes some situations you can't. But any time that I can just stop and do that step backwards and simply sit still allows me to not upset the apple cart so much that it's just going to go over the cliff and down the road. It's not easy and it isn't always possible, but that's been one thing that I have found useful.
Because I don't want to... one of my New Year's things was escape. I don't want to escape it either.
Right. That's why I say sitting very still with it and just letting it be right there. That's kind of what Kakumi was talking about, too. It's like checking in. What's really going on right now?
And I would say, like, the goal there is not really to figure it out.
Right.
Is to have a good answer about, like, oh, what is going on?
Right.
But it's just that the act of observing closely, where we're kind of like, we can't quite see, and we, like, look closer, and we, you know, we have to kind of lean in to see more clearly, that changes us. That puts us in a different state, which is probably not feeling as much pressure. It's probably not feeling as, like, constricted and tight and limited. And it, like, there's just something that's naturally kind of aligning about noticing ourselves. And that's a better place to make decisions from.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, Chris.
I noticed it was really hard for me to do it, and I would avoid it.
Yeah.
When I started doing it, I'd get distracted and not be able to get through the night, the whole day.
Yeah.
Or like an impulse.
Sounds like Zazen.
Yeah.
So when you say it's hard to do it, just that you would get distracted or you would fall asleep.
I would get distracted or I'd fall asleep, but it was also very uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And not because necessarily I was noticing what judgments or other discomfortable things I did throughout the day were, but just... it was just sort of uncomfortable to recall what was before, like what was important about or not important.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's some like personal history about why it was uncomfortable for me, but it was uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that's like a significant minority of people find that. I don't think it's half the room, but more than 30%, I would guess. You want to straw poll that? How many people basically find that to be a kind of uneasy process? So, yeah, you're in good company. That's 30 to 50%, say. That doesn't mean it's not worthwhile. It just means that, like, a little extra. Kind of moving into it with a little extra compassion, a little extra kind of care and patience is needed. And that, you know, that there's layers. And so the layer that we're in touch with right now might be really uncomfortable. Spend enough, like, kind of careful time there, you know, time with loving attention. My guess is that you're going to find a different layer underneath that. So. So, yeah, don't force it. Don't like kind of set a sense of like, okay, now I've got to like just burn through this all in the next week. Just, you know, little bits at a time, and that seems to be the more reliable way of sticking with it.
I've also found that if I try to do zazen right before I go to bed, I have the same sort of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's harder to sleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing you could try is just doing it early in the day and doing it for the day before, or just for a small chunk. I mean, you may just be a morning person, I don't know.
being in that 30%, I tend to, my default habit is to add embarrassment to it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like, again, really?
Yeah, so that kind of secondary commentary.
Yeah, it's like, right. What? You're still doing that?
Sure.
That's so embarrassing.
Yeah, and, you know, like we're very well conditioned on that front, so I'm sure that's 100%, that's part of the experience for people here. And, you know, as you notice that, you know, also allowing that to drop away, it's not exactly what we're doing right now, it's just some of the scenery, some of the side effects, and there's more interesting stuff happening. It's, you know, like, the kind of the blanket, the dismissal, the editing out of the judgment is largely ineffective.
Mm.
I mean, it's effective in the short term, but it doesn't really change anything. But caring more about other aspects of it really does. But it's fun. Yeah.
I found it interesting that in the sort of process of trying to recollect my day, and I really kind of visualized it like that, right? Like collecting the little pieces, the moments of the day, not with a desire for attachment to them or to try to understand necessarily or even solve them, but just to see them again,
right,
in a different light. How that process, there was this like tension, kind of as you talked about, like the resistance or the embarrassment piece of it, or the discomfort that you speak of. I definitely observed that. And then when I was able to find those little moments of just setting that aside and noticing that it was there, but just setting it aside, I found it also helped create this little bit of spaciousness during the day as well, in terms of being able to be in the moment. I don't quite know yet, or I haven't quite sat with the connection necessarily, but something felt different about this week in the process of recollecting.
I noticed there was quite a few nods in the circle as you talked about that correlation, so I think that's a shared experience. Nice observation. Good. So please keep doing that. And I would say for this next week, you know, with a recitation of the Kyoji Kaimon or the recollection of the day, especially look at the next three precepts. So we're going to do the first three tonight. Over the next week, really examine 4, 5, and 6. And, you know, using the recitation, using the recollection, kind of notice how those show up in your life. All right, so do not kill. Cultivate and encourage life. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, this is page 39. Holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. The life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill Buddha. So, first precept, all of the other of the 10 precepts kind of collapse into this one in one way or another. It's, you know, in any list of precepts, and there's, like, the Buddhist canon has probably 30 different lists of precepts, at least. Do not kill is always the first one, or some version thereof. There's all of the 10 great precepts have the same pattern of it has the prohibitory version, do not kill, the more like a positive framing, cultivate and encourage life. And then it has this realm of the absolute peace by Bodhidharma. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. So that's taking, you know, looking at it with a wisdom view. The life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill Buddha. That's Dogen's commentary. And that's the more relative or embodied view. And so in our practice with these, we're not trying to, you know, fix one particular way of relating to the precepts, but have a fluidity, have a flexibility of moving between these three different lenses of approaching the precept as appropriate given the situation. So there's kind of an inherent malleability to this, which it tends to make people a little nervous, kind of trained in Western ethics, where we really tend to want to find the rules, tend to want to find the this is how it is. And that's not what you'll find here. So it's the prototype. Oh yes, Don.
I don't know what to make of it, but when I look at these and I say them the other way around, positive first and then negative second, then it goes, oh, I get this now. And I don't know why that makes a difference to say cultivate and encourage life, do not kill, as opposed to do not kill, cultivate and encourage life. Somehow it just, I don't know, something about my Western mind, I guess. It just seems to make more sense the other way around.
Okay. Yeah. I'd say when you're chanting as a group, do it like this, but on your own, do whatever works for you.
Okay.
So it's the I think it kind of at the essential layer, this precept is about a disavowing of our inherent connectedness. You know, that there's a real fundamental connection that we all are enacting, and trying to draw a line through that, trying to find a separation there, enforcing that into the world is what this is about. With all the precepts, there's a huge range of kind of subtlety, coarseness of behavior. But that's kind of what it would reduce to here. So, yeah, Rachel.
I was just going to say, I've been staring at these for almost a year now, since precept classes last year. And staring at this particular sheet of paper, actually, and I realized something recently, and I thought it was helpful, which is that there's this big dash line between the negative and the positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for whatever reason, I'm like, oh, that's the line between the two ends. They're on the same line. It's the extremes of both sides, and mm-hmm. we always fall somewhere in between. So it's kind of like we're living mm-hmm. somewhere on that mm-hmm. dash.
Mm-hmm. Funny. So taking that basic idea, I'd like to just kind of have a moment of mindfulness. where try to find like how you encounter that, like the first sensation of killing, right? Like, how do you recognize that cutting off? So the easiest way to do that is to just, first of all, land in your experience. So, you know, you're in this room, it's this temperature, you're sitting in whatever posture you're in, you're hearing the rain and my voice and whatever else, shuffling. There's probably some aspect of your experience which isn't preferred. That's a good place to look. So, what you're looking for specifically here is a very, like, initial, very, like, quiet physical sensation of cutting off, pushing away. You don't have to describe what it is that you're pushing away, but you're trying to find that physical sensation. Okay. Nod if you've got something. Oh wow, we don't have very many. Okay, let's try this. So if you did find something, maybe the nods were just slow. If you did find something, can we get a couple of, you know, popcorn that out a little bit and it might help people zoom in on that?
Tight jaw.
Tight jaw? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was like the back of my palate went up.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Really tight chest and feet.
Yeah, yeah. And could you feel that happening? Mm-hmm. Or okay. Great.
Shallow breath.
Shallow breath, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pressure toward the front of my body.
Uh-huh.
Closing my ribs.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's when I was getting some of that.
My arms are towards my body.
Uh-huh.
So, I still have a lot of fear, but in social situations, and so there's definitely a conscious effort for me to not do this, you know,
uh-huh.
And shrink away. It's a conscious effort there to try to not cut off.
Okay.
A sharpness and a hardening kind of sensation?
Yeah, kind of throughout.
Just thinking about...
Yeah. But, I mean, did you encounter that sharpness and hardening kind of throughout the body, or...?
Especially the upper body.
Yeah.
It's almost like there was kind of this spotlight in my heart, and suddenly I could, like, feel the pulsing.
Uh-huh.
And it increased.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, what did anyone notice kind of perceptual shifts, like how the room felt, or how like kind of the flavor of thought, emotional tone, changes of that nature? Some of the observations so far have been kind of like on that borderline.
Actually felt more receptive in the present room. I felt more love in my heart. Loss of the senses. Loss of the sense of seeing.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Kind of cold and tired.
Yeah.
And annoyed at feeling cold and tired.
Uh-huh.
And then thinking how, oh, that's because I'm not getting what I want, and it's not what I think is I.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And how that that leads to the rationalization of why it's okay to kill the moth in the pantry.
Sure.
It's just my idea of how it should be. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's really like being able to find that for each precept and kind of recognize those differences is useful. Not that it's always going to be the same. I mean, because it obviously won't. But like cluing in on those flavors, it gives you it makes it easier to recognize. Especially, and you know, like you think that it would be easy to recognize, well, is this stealing or is this killing? Like, it's not that it really like matters which category it's in, but being able to like, oh right, that's stealing. In the midst of it, like we get really confused, right? Like, situations are fast and they're complex and there's lots of, you know, rationales in all different directions. And so to just have something really simple, feeling tone or physicality, which you recognize, you trust, like, all right, that particular kind of like furtive queasiness, that's stealing, right? Like if I can feel that kind of twist right there. Like I know somehow, somewhere in this like situation, like I'm trying to get away with something, right? You want those. Yeah, and so like for me, like there's a kind of like a blur, like with the killing that like, you know, I can watch for that. So you know, you find your own, you kind of build your own vocabulary of how you break precepts, right? That'll evolve over time, but I want to kind of keep coming back to that and you know, looking for that. It's like a handle to make it easier. So zooming in on do not kill, cultivate and encourage life. It's a precept which comes up a lot. There's a lot of really easy conversations from this, you know, meal moths and vegetarianism and, you know, the kind of social exclusion and, you know, like climate change and our kind of implicit, you know, killing just by nature of the culture we're in. And I mean, there's many, many, many ways in which we're involved in killing one way or another. So what's like, what do people care about tonight? What's one that we can just kind of look at? Not that we're going to like try to figure it out, but that we can sort of look at these different lenses, look at a problem through these different lenses.
Related to this precept?
This is a precept that kind of got me into Buddhism. Like this was I was working a job where I had to kill rats. You know, that was wasn't my only job, but like I was part of what I did was I killed rats in a psychopharm lab. And up until that point in my career I hadn't like I knew that it was an issue, I knew that it was kind of a thing to think about, but I hadn't had time to really think about it. And in this work situation I had time to kind of well, okay, so what do I really think about this? And what happened was I realized like I didn't trust myself to make that decision. I didn't, you know, have access to precepts, basically. You know, so I went looking, and that eventually ended me up here. So that I really this process of examining our life through this lens is really life changing. That totally 180 for me.
I hate meat like all my study Buddhism.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like work. Work, eating meat.
Sure.
Eating fish, fishing, hunting.
Right.
And all of those things. And now, like, I just the other day I was thinking about feeling, being mindful of my feelings, and I opened the curtain a bit, and now I'm on the other
thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm in the same boat with that one. It's almost like Buddhism gave me permission to explore those feelings and feel strong in that cultural decision. Because I came from a background where being a vegetarian was, you don't do that.
Right.
Myself overanalyzing it quite a bit because I've struggled with going back and forth between vegetarianism because I think about all the things that get killed on a regular basis just so I can exist,
sure.
including the microbes in my system which are currently dying in this cold that's lingering. obviously I don't have any control over that. But then I think about, well, plants are also living and I wonder where do they live in that cycle and I wonder
how it would be. Yeah. So let's, we can take that as, a way to look at this, right? So, there's the do not kill, cultivate, encourage life, right? The simple, literal version. There's the absolute view of really like nothing can be killed, right? There's no cessation, no cause, like that, you read the Heart Sutra, and that, like, paring away at any divvying up, right? So, any dichotomy, any separation is not quite it. So that view is also true. And then the life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill Buddha. How does that? What does that do? That's more like you have the kind of the literal, the absolute, and then this compassionate version. What does the third verse do here?
For me,
yeah, go for it.
For me, it says, continue the life of Buddha, do not kill Buddha. For me personally, it felt like I was not being genuine, I was not being myself if I continue to use animals for insurance, and in that way, it sort of added an extra layer of if I'm not being genuine, that is also a way of killing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that extra layer was just made it a little bit more convincing that just for me, it was a good step to take.
Mm-hmm. For me, this is really speaking about the awareness there and noticing how we're affected, that the life of Buddha, that life of awareness, that life of enlightening activity, as we're, dealing with, choices like this, how are we affected and what's that, what are those ripple effects? And there's not a, like, that's something that has to be discovered in each person's life. Like, there's not an answer that we can kind of read this and say, oh, yeah, that's what it'll be. It's an experiment. You have to test it. How are we impacted by different actions? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it can be pretty complex. In my household, my partner is not vegetarian.
Right.
We share the cooking.
Yeah.
And the compromise we've come to is when she cooks with me and I eat with her, and I cook vegetarian and she eats with me.
Yeah.
And to not do that is to to kill something else, you know, to kill this sharing of the food and the meal. And so I think this second one in particular kind of moves it to that level of looking at the whole picture and not just it, at that aspect of killing an animal.
Right, thanks. Yeah.
I've gone back and forth in my life, probably like many people in the room, with being a vegetarian or not. Something that just occurred to me in looking at this precept, and that the first line, cultivate and encourage life, I feel like I can also translate to cultivate and encourage aliveness, like a living sense of connection and tension and grappling with the precept and what that means in my life. And at different points, it's meant different things. And like, for example, when I worked on a farm and I was very intimately connected with that cycle of growing plants that fed animals who were then slaughtered and for consumption, and then feeding people, and waste from that going back into the land, that didn't necessarily feel like a cutting off of life for me, that there was very much a continuation of that cycle that was necessary for the vitality of that farm. And yet, in that goal to cultivate and encourage life or aliveness, I don't know, something about that word makes it a little more engaging for me. I think it becomes okay to kind of move on that kind of dash line that you're talking about. And I appreciate that tension, that not forcing per se, but it nudges us to be constantly engaging in the conversation.
I think that kind of orientation to aliveness is really useful. That there's, it's, and that's part of what I was getting at by trying to get like, was there a perceptual shift? Like, you know, the intensity to which we're aware varies dramatically, you know, over minutes. And it's a useful variable to watch.
There's a kind of death that comes from not engaging.
Yes.
There's a part of ourselves that dies off that is important to consider just as much as the lives.
Maybe one more on this one, and then we're going to move on to.
What struck me was the continue the life of Buddha, do not kill Buddha.
Yeah.
It just seems like it goes back to continuing the process from the very beginning, and it's up to each one of us to continue that and eventually become Buddhists ourselves.
Right. Yeah, feeling that kind of flow through time of enlightening activity and practice, and not creating a pause there. Nice. All right. Do not steal. Honor the gift not yet given. In the realm of the unattainable Dharma, holding no thought of gain is a precept of not stealing. The self and the things of the world are just as they are. The mind and its object are one. The gateway to enlightenment stands open wide. So let's start here with what's the basic flavor of dissatisfaction here, that like when you think about okay something that you stole in the last month, right, whatever it may be, whether that's time, whether that's attention, whether that's a candy bar, whether that's a car, whether that's, you know, whatever it may be, you know, you did something and there was that kind of like grasping, sneaking, furtive something about it. So just kind of call up that event. Remember, you know, what the situation was, what was happening before that, you know, the kind of storyline that was you were in the process with, anything about like kind of tone, posture, voice that might show up, people who you are around, setting? So there's something about there's a kind of a basic dissatisfaction there. Can people zoom in on that? And so I want to get that, but before people say that, right before that, there's something that basically feels good. And so I want you to notice both of those. Like before that kind of whatever was icky started, there was something that was really basically pleasurable. So what do you notice?
I was thinking circumstance where the pleasurable part was like, all right, one for the little guy. Uh-huh. And then on the bad part, I was like, you know, in the big picture, what am I getting out of this? It was, I bought pineapple, and the sign said 2 for $4. And I rang it up, and they were $1.50. Uh-huh. Yeah! But then as I'm leaving the store, I'm kind of skulking out. I'm so bad because I didn't say anything.
Right. Good. So that, so you got the, that kind of skulking out, like, am I going to be caught, seen, understood, etc.
You know, and I still feel
that misalignment, right.
The pineapple's gone.
Yeah, oh sure, sure.
It's still here. Yeah.
It's funny how that works. So there's that, so the positive part there is that basic, like wishing for ease, really. That's really wholesome, you know, like whether it's ease because like pineapple tastes good or ease because like, this will not cost so much or whatever it may be, that there's something really wholesome about that wishing, right? So I want to like affirm that part of it and then notice the twist that happens. What happens out of that basic, you know, kind of happy wanting? And so let's hear a couple more, see if we can pull out a pattern.
Mine is usually around connection.
Yeah.
With another person.
Yeah.
And when the connection is there and there's openness and it just feels easy and sweet, and then when it's cut off, I have a little mental temper tantrum, and you know, and then this kicks in, and I'm like, I don't want anything from you that you're not prepared to give me. Mm-hmm. That's my version of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the before and after is connection and then not connection.
Right.
And it's not like a physical, actual, separating connection.
Yeah.
It's all, a lot of it's in my mind.
Sure.
And it's it can be instantaneous, and then it can come back, you know, 3 seconds later.
Yeah.
But it's that doubt that the openness with the other people is there.
Yeah, I had one today where I was, I had a 3 o'clock meeting that, you know, was slow and like drawn out, and I didn't have a whole lot to, I didn't really need to be part of it, and I felt like, and this, you know, this, so the basic wanting to be helpful, wanting to, you know, that was there. And then it got contorted by this sense of scarcity of time and mental energy and kind of emotional openness. And I just closed in and, like, you know, energetically and, like, distanced myself from the conversation. And and I fidgeted, and you know, like, so that was, yeah, it's very apparent.
The context internally. For mine is lately it's my boss.
Uh-huh.
We've just gone through a gigantic multi-million-dollar transformation.
Sure.
We're on day 16, and everyone's stressed out.
Yeah.
And whenever she sits next to me, and whenever I ask her a question, she gets defensive.
Yeah.
No matter what it is.
Yeah.
So I approach with openness, connection, idea, solution, and she like shuts me out.
Yeah.
And it happens instantaneously. And what I want is, I don't want it that way.
Right. Yeah.
And she's not prepared to be open.
Right.
I struggle more with the expectation that, like in connection, the desire that I have or what's coming through naturally isn't wanted, and so I feel ashamed of that. And I have been doing a lot of work on stepping forward anyways and making requests, and so this one feels particularly confusing. It feels very like, damn if I do, damn if I don't.
Yeah. So how do you relate that to this one? Can you be more specific there?
Well, definitely there's moments of like stealing and so on, but the physical sensation is if there's like a desire to reach out for something, then the sensation is so much more of a contraction and a shame and like a no, that's not what others want, and so I increase my sense of separation to protect the world for me.
Right.
I remember what you're saying. I see what you're saying. It's like you're stealing from yourself in the end, really. You're stealing the opportunity to connect because you're filtering yourself.
Yeah, it feels related to the last precept, do not kill them, cutting off my own naturalness. There's something just there. That as well. I used to steal. Just going to put that out there. I used to steal. I'm not proud of it, but at the time there was definitely a feeling of, oh good, I need this thing, I'm taking it, I'm taking care of myself. There was an initial feeling of like positivity of you were describing a moment. Good, I have this thing now, or I'm about to have this thing. It's then followed by this feeling of jumping forward a few steps. It's followed by a feeling of what if I had just asked for help instead? And I rob myself of that wholesome experience of asking for help and receiving help.
Yeah. Yeah, so for any given situation, there could be, you know, a whole host of ways in which like you might trace that onto the precept there. For you know, that kind of little cluster there, this the self and things of the world are just as they are, the mind and its objects are one. The gateway to enlightenment stands open wide. The part of what it's getting at there is the that it's open wide, like the abundance, like the gratitude piece, and a lot of the fear stuff is it's some perception of not enough somehow, right? And so we have to do something extra, we have to break a precept in order to get what we need, or what we think we're going to need, or what we might need in the future, or whatever it may be, and it rests on this basic perception of not enough, and that's what this is. Pointing to, like, if you can see, like, the radiant abundance, which is, like, you know, here for us, like, this kind of dissolves, like, the impetus in this direction dissolves. But it's, you know, it's hard to talk ourselves into that when we're not there. Shinya, you were going to say something?
I was also thinking about that moment that you described, that before the icky moment, there's this pleasurable moment, and I think it has to do with that gateway standing open wide. And so I was thinking, well, actually, I was thinking about taking a cookie from the freezer.
Mm-hmm. Who has taken a cookie from the freezer?
And that positive moment is the thought of happiness,
yeah.
Really. But then it shrinks a little bit because it becomes the thought of, oh, more happiness than I have right now. Uh-huh. And that's possible. Uh-huh. And then that shrinks even more into, oh, the more happiness is possible if I go and get a cookie from the freezer. And then by the time I get the cookie, I was just like, you know,
it's a little crumb of happiness. Well, solved that one. Okay, honor to not the sexuality.
If you're gonna honor the gift, not the given, you gotta wait until they serve the Can I say?
Yeah, please.
What you said the other day, when she was taking a pineapple.
Yeah.
One for the little guy.
Yeah.
It's, you're feeding the ego for that brief moment. Mm-hmm. Make this bigger for a second. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're very adept at rationalizing and giving ourselves justifications for doing what we do. And, like, that's just, I mean, I don't know, like, I do sounds and, like, everybody is fluent. Like, we're just great as a population explaining why we do what we do.
Yeah.
It's not all that credible, you know, if we're mindful as we do it. But it's definitely, you know, it can just roll right off the tongue. So, yeah, I've got lots of aversions there. Anything else people want to really got to get in here? Yeah.
Honor the gift not yet given. Mm-hmm. Keep thinking, oh, well, if you just wait, they're going to give it to you. But you won't have to steal it. But I don't think that's really what it means.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's quite so concrete. I think, like, maybe because, yeah, I mean, there's no guarantee that the cookie's going to be served, right? Or the pineapple's going to be offered. It's, it might not work like that. And so there's a real open-handedness that's necessary there. It might be, it might not be. And that's why, like, you know, starting with this, being able to connect to that, oh, there's happiness, right? Oh, like, and part of that happiness is like, oh, like, I want to feel, you know, I want that, like, taste is sweet, right? It doesn't matter that it's like, that's a translation of something more basic, mm. Right? But there's that kind of wanting, which is just basically nice. Once it kind of solidifies around, like, oh, here's my strategy for getting that something nice, you know, that's grasping, you know, then, you know, suffering is following. But that initial kind of first, second, and then version of, like, I want is actually pretty blameless. And so to be able to, like, just allow that much and not have to follow it up, not have to, like, meet each, like, we have this assumption that if I have that desire and I don't fulfill it, like, it's going to get worse. But that's not actually what happens. Mm-hmm. The getting worse is once I've decided how I'm going to satisfy that desire, and then it doesn't happen, and then, you know, do.
Yeah. Honor the gift that might never be given.
Yeah.
But there's also a difference between, like, real needs and false needs, like a desire to have a better experience, but sometimes, like, the desire that we have is actually pretty important.
Sure. But I'm kind of talking, like, even so yeah, like, we need a sense of safety, right? And, like, so there may be a desire for that sense of safety. There may be a desire for that taste of sweetness, right? They're not equivalent, but the experience of both, you know, like there's a basic like affirmingness of that initial experience before the grasping starts. Mm-hmm. And that's the same in both. That's my experience of it. Alrighty. Okay. It takes more time. Oh, okay. Go for it.
I keep getting hung up on the word object. The first sentence of the second paragraph.
The mind and its object are one, so that's just like whatever is in view, whatever the mind lands on. So that could be a concept, that could be a person, that could be a relationship, that could be a thing. Yeah. It's like subject to object. That's the object it's talking about. Anything that's not the perceiver. All right. Do not misuse sexuality. Remain faithful in relationships. In the realm of the ungilded Dharma, not coveting or creating a veneer of attachment is the precept of not misusing sexuality. The three wheels are pure and clear. When there is nothing to desire, we follow the way of all that is. So, I find that at its, like, I'm kind of trying to, we'll do a little shorter version, I'm speeding this up a little bit. So, what I find here is that the kind of the kernel of this precept has to do with the veneer of attachment, this kind of creating a projection of who someone is or what something would be or how I'll experience something that is apart from the actual lived experience. It's that kind of projecting outward of desire onto a situation or a person. One of the palpable cues I find there is a sense of like off balance, like starting to get like pulled one way or another. I think, you know, all of these will have some of this kind of parallel with each other. You can take a lesson learned from one and apply it here. You know, like there's this, likewise with like the do not steal, there's this very basic kind of primal instinct towards not to, that we kind of recognize sameness and oneness, right? And that's a wholesome influx into this precept, and then it can get contorted easily. The three wheels are pure and clear. That's referring to giver, receiver, and gift. So again, kind of the subject-object piece there. Does that make sense? That was a very quick explanation.
There's something, I think you might have answered my question, but I'm not.
Yeah.
Do not misuse sexuality.
Yeah.
You mentioned that not to put like imagined on someone.
Right.
So what is the right way to use the sexuality? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
so a wrong way would be that energy comes up,
right,
and then you paste it on a situation.
Right, you're more relating to your desire or to your, you know, whatever you want out of a situation, mm-hmm. you know, than what the situation actually is. So remain faithful in relationships, you know, that can be, that, you know, it sounds like a romantic relationship, but it could also be like just, my relationship to this situation, teaching this class, is that I want to be authentic and open and honest here, right? So that's, you know, remaining faithful to that relationship of teaching this class, right? who do you want to be in a given situation? Like, what is your, like, unfolding of your life out in a given context?
Would you say sexuality is a useful tool in those situations?
Gosh. Well, I would say that, like, sexuality is kind of an inherent part of who we are, and you know, it gets, you know, it shows up all over the place, and you know, so we have to be kind of aware of that, and you know, using that. It sounds funny to call it a tool. I don't know, something about that, like, makes me a little nervous. Yeah. Chris?
There's several things about this that I started to get kind of fun, but one of them is sort of related to what you and Amber were just talking about, which is faithfulness in relationships seems bigger than sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, unlike the others, it feels like sexuality is a smaller piece of relationships, the relationships as a whole. And the rest of it makes more sense to me if I think about it as like how to be in relationship with others.
Yeah.
But the sexuality piece just feels like focusing on just one aspect of relationship.
Sure.
And highlighting it in a way that is often, dismissive of very important aspects, and also sort of harmful in the way that women in particular have been regarded as sexual beings in many religions.
Yeah. I think that's one reason why, you know, we tend to talk about this as, you know, not the small version of just sexuality, but really this is, you know, who we are to other people. And who other people are to us. That's a more broader and accurate phrasing. I think some of this is just historical. You know, that's how it has you know, been litigated. So we have that kind of, you know, we inherit that byproduct. Yeah.
So in the sense that, like, the first precept is the positive, cultivating, and encouraging life, and not doing that, you know, gets worse and worse and worse until you get to killing, which is like the worst example of not doing that possible. But then I think the same thing applies here. If your goal is to remain faithful in relationships, the absolute, you could be less and less faithful in the absolute. Most egregious thing would be to misuse sexuality, so that you know, creating a veneer, of attachment, trying to convince somebody that you love them, that you don't, or covering someone that's somebody else's. But
well, I think that sexuality and sexual energy is actually a part of our relationships. Almost all of our relationships on some level. And we tend to not think of it that way because it's not overtly sexual, physical, whatever. But that energy is there. You know, a good friendship, there's definitely some sexual energy there. And so this business of, you know, putting it into a place of desire and putting your projections onto people is something we do all the time. And it's something to be really aware of and pay attention to. So to me, it isn't so much about sex, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. It's really about understanding that that energy is there regardless of what we're doing and who we're talking about and what that relationship is.
In some ways, I think it's another way to view that sexuality is also sort of the power balances in a relationship, maybe. When talking about the way those different energies come together, I think about potential sort of power under power over dynamic in a relationship, and whether there's true consent and full awareness of how that relationship is happening.
I can go
what you're sharing really resonates, and I find that in my system there's like three seeds of the self. There's like the mental, the heart, and the emotional, and there's like the seed of the self. And when each of them are open, then they have a texture to them. And framing it that way, like, now this is one that I struggle with, because that sort of intimacy and attraction and lack of separateness, when the seed of the self is really open, it's powerful. It's not something that I'm doing a lot of, like, subconscious work, and I don't trust the seed of myself right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, like, it's painful to keep it closed.
Rachel?
Going back to the idea of not creating a veneer of attachment, mm-hmm. I really like the phrase here, ungilded dharma.
Yeah.
Because when I think about, you know, a lot of sexuality, when you think of it in its, you know, most basic form, is about this, you know, dressing up of the self, or mm-hmm. looking for someone who is dressed up. You know, it's a very visual thing. And it's a veneer. It's something you've created for yourself, or they created in order to attract mm-hmm. someone, mm-hmm. and you're projecting things onto them, and that may or may not be there. And once you've come together, that veneer may disappear, and maybe they aren't what you expected. Maybe you're not what they expected. And it's that idea of, remember, like, this is just a facade. There's more to the relationship than this part, and when you focus so much on that aspect, you miss the bigger picture.
Yeah, and I think just to kind of tie this together, and you know we're out of time now, but I want to just underline that that veneer will happen not just in the purely sexual realm, but in any like aspect of relating to people. And two, that a lot of this work is in how we perceive it. It's not just in the behavior, or, you know, am I, you know, like cheating on my wife, or whatever it may be. Like, it's how I'm perceiving situations. And that's precepts right there. Is watching those kind of unspoken, like, how do I see the world working? And what am I, like, imagining, what am I assuming about situations? And, you know, basically, like, how is myself getting out there, and am I seeing that reflected back at me? And being able to, like, catch those and kind of pare that away as we go. Okay, so we got through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 for next week. We'll be Vespers in a few minutes.
Yeah.